Hi, I'm John Trader, Director of Communications with Right Patient, the healthcare industry's most flexible and scalable biometric patient safety and patient data integrity system, supporting any form of biometrics, including fingerprint, finger vein, palm vein, iris, facial, and voice recognition. Our mission through these podcasts is to help educate, inform, and inspire through conversations with leading professionals for information, analysis, and opinions on the biggest issues and challenges in the healthcare industry. I'm particularly excited for today's podcast because we have the honor of speaking with Jim Bialik, president of the Patient Safety Movement, about his work to advance patient safety in healthcare. Although patient safety has theoretically always been a focus in healthcare, the topic was perhaps thrust into the national spotlight with the Institute of Medicine's 1999 report entitled "To Err is Human," which at the time reported that medical errors caused between 44,000 and 98,000 deaths every year in American hospitals and over 1 million injuries. When you factor in the patient safety risks created by the push to digitize healthcare and the passage of 2009's High Tech Act, which promoted the adoption and meaningful use of health information technology, maintaining patient safety continues to be an extremely complex and challenging effort. Before we begin our discussion today, let's first learn a little bit more about our guest. Jim Bialik is a known expert on health information technology policy, the regulation of emerging health technologies, and public health system design. He has a keen interest in the overall modernization of healthcare and works with stakeholders to develop new and innovative ways to personalize the care experience in a way that will lead to the sustainable improvement of health systems, make healthcare safer, and reduce costs. Prior to joining the Patient Safety Movement Foundation, Jim was the co-founder and former executive director of the Newborn Foundation and the Newborn Coalition, two action-based nonprofit organizations focused on education and advocacy to improve maternal and child health, both domestically and internationally. In his role with the Newborn Foundation, Jim has secured international funding for two major population health screening programs, and was a key architect in the world's largest pulse oximetry screening pilot program targeting congenital heart disease, neonatal sepsis, and neonatal pneumonia. The program is currently underway across six provinces in China. As executive director of the Newborn Coalition, Jim has played a leading role in the drafting, development, or passage of 33 state laws mandating newborn screening for congenital heart disease. In 2 years, these advocacy efforts have increased the number of newborns screened in the United States by more than 4,000%. Wow. Jim has played a key role in reforming public safety programs for the evolution of healthcare-related technologies. He's testified twice before the Energy and Commerce Committee in the U.S. House of Representatives on the regulation of future technologies and remains a trusted advisor to several members of Congress and senators on technology issues. Jim is also former Senior Vice President for Public Policy for Horizon Government Affairs in Washington, D.C., where he led health information technology and medical device policy development across five diverse coalitions representing over 200 corporations and nonprofit organizations. Welcome to the podcast, and thank you for your time today, Jim.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jim, today's topic is patient safety in healthcare, which we really can't stress how important and significant it is to advance this initiative. And I'd like to begin our discussion with a brief overview of the patient safety movement and your goal of achieving zero preventable deaths by the year 2020. Jim, what can you tell us about the patient safety movement mission and goals, and what steps are you taking and what accomplishments have been realized since you began the movement?
Sure. The Patient Safety Movement Foundation was founded 3 years ago, and it was an initiative of the Masimo Foundation. So you may know of the company based on their non-invasive monitoring technologies. And really, it was born out of the IOM report that you referenced previously. At the time, in 2000, when that came out, they were saying, you know, you had about 100,000 people that were preventably dying every year. And then in 2010, there was another report that came out saying that number had doubled. And then in 2014, we'd even seen some reports that said that the number of preventable deaths was as high as 440,000 people that were dying preventably every year. Mm-hmm. And I think the organization really coalesced around the issue that it's getting worse every year. And what can we do? What are some of the actionable solutions that we can put in place right now to make sure that this number of preventable deaths starts decreasing instead of increasing exponentially every year. So we, as an organization, are really focused on networking. So what we do is we secure commitments from providers and from hospitals that are implementing something that is working in improving patient safety. So in doing that, we look at what are the hospitals that are doing an absolutely amazing job that something that what they're doing can be implemented in hospitals nationwide, so that if there's a hospital that is trying to address an issue, they have somewhere to go. They have somewhere to connect. And we really became a network of shared learning in that way. So we work with healthcare institutions so that they're able to connect with others so that they can be most impactful in patient safety. We work with industry in getting them to commit to openly sharing their data. Interoperability is a big part of patient safety. And you referenced meaningful use in the HITECH Act. Here we are 6 years after the HITECH Act, and we're still trying to get interoperability under control. And a lot of the promises of health IT, like clinical decision support and some of the other items that really require data to be actively shared in order to harness the potential of the technology, we're just not there yet. And quite honestly, we don't have the data systems in place to make sure that data is extremely valuable to every person that is accessing it. So we really are working with medical technology companies, medical device companies, health IT companies to get them to share their data, so that we can more actively use that data in the pursuit of patient safety. And I would say the other two groups we really work with are patient advocates, because really patient stories are a huge part of the context for why it's so important to be engaged in this field. When we talk about interoperability, it sounds like it's in the abstract. It sounds like something that just doesn't quite merge with the actual patient. But quite honestly, this is individual data we're talking about, so we want to make sure that it's most valuable to the individual themselves as well as the provider. And then also we work with policymakers, because healthcare is an extremely regulated market, so we're really focused on making sure that incentives are properly aligned, that folks can work together when they want to work together, and that something like health information technology or something like hospitals enacting these actionable patient safety solutions have all the resources they need in order to be most effective.
Thanks for the overview, Jim. I really can't stress enough how important your mission is to not only bring patient safety to the forefront of healthcare priorities, but also your efforts that have visibly raised consciousness about this topic and your actions set forth to improve it. I actually had the opportunity to go extensively through your website, and you mentioned earlier about some patient stories, and there's a great tab on your site that provides a really firsthand look at the effect that medical errors can have on patient safety. It's pretty powerful in terms of getting that message out there. So your website is a great resource. We're going to talk a little bit about that later in the podcast. But I did notice on your site that the Patient Safety Movement is sponsoring the Patient Safety Movement Foundation Innovation Competition to encourage advocates to submit innovations to advance the goal of zero preventable deaths by the year 2020. Jim, what can you tell me about the motivation behind creating that award and how you feel it will help advance the patient safety initiative?
The Patient Safety Movement Innovation Competition is very focused on what kind of products or processes that are out there that are seeing some success in improving patient safety that really just need help scaling up. A lot of what we see as far as addressing patient safety issues are based in things that really can be addressed right now, but they just, through either improvement of best practices or better monitoring or other activities, can be addressed right away. What we're really focused on is trying to highlight what is being effective and how we can put attention on that so that more people are implementing those solutions.
Okay. Thanks for that overview, Jim. I also understand that the patient safety movement will host a summit this coming January, which piqued our interest. Jim, can you talk to me for a minute about the upcoming Patient Safety Science and Technology Summit in January 2016? And what I'm particularly interested in is what the significance of this event is, why people should attend, and what one message do you hope attendees walk away with?
Well, I can start with the end of that, which is the one message that we want people to take away from attending our summit is that they have a role in patient safety. And the summit is unlike any event that I've ever been to. And you know, I was an attendee for the first two patient safety summits before I came on board. And then I've been president for one, and we're looking forward to our 2016 summit. But This isn't another conference. You know, I've been to a lot of conferences, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners have been to a lot of conferences. And we didn't want just another thing that you had to attend, another hotel, another event that really wasn't worth your time. We're really focused on highlighting the people that are doing the most good in patient safety. So in the previous years, we've had heads of state. President Clinton comes every year. Vice President Biden was there for the 2015 summit. We also have leaders in healthcare. Peter Pronovost has been in attendance. We've had the Joint Commission as a co-convener in a previous year. And then we also have leaders in health IT highlighting their commitment to improve patient safety and to share patient data. The event is really focused on who are the ones doing the most good and how can we replicate that success elsewhere in healthcare. So it really is focused on getting the hospitals, healthcare professionals engaged, medical technology companies, patient advocates, and of course we have the public policy element as well. I would say the reason to attend is because it's a very small, it's a very intimate event, which is a great opportunity for those that are really engaged in patient safety to connect with one another, mm-hmm. as well as to hopefully learn from one another. Like I said, as an organization, we're very much a platform or a network of shared learning. And this is the center of the wheel. And we really get a very amazing group of people that attend the conference every year. And I look forward to it just as an attendee, let alone as someone that plays a part in planning the event.
And Jim, will you be actually also inviting patients to come to the event to share some of their stories about how lapses in patient safety have affected or adversely affected their health?
Absolutely. We have patient advocates both in attendance and as a part of every one of our panels. We try to, as an organization, we're really trying to bring multi-stakeholder groups together so that they can better work together. So that's the healthcare professional community, that's industry, that's the public policy community, as well as patient advocates. And so every panel has some representation from each of those groups. Also, we produce what we call patient and family stories that are based on the issues that we are challenges we're choosing to address for each year. And we do that for two reasons. One is we like to put together what is a high production value video interview, kind of documentary style, a patient story so people understand the depth and breadth of the issue. But also because a big part of what we do is trying to encourage patient advocates to get and remain involved. And so we hope that their time as a part of our summit and these kind of documentary stories that we produce are something that they can use in their own advocacy. So the patient voice is central to what we do.
It's going back to something you brought up earlier about raising awareness about the issue of patient safety. I in no way have anywhere near as much knowledge about patient safety as you do. But one of the things that I have observed just through reading different articles about the topic and going to places like the Patient Safety Movement website is that one of the main weapons against battling medical errors that are caused by myriad different conditions in a hospital is raising awareness about a patient's role in patient safety. I think when patients hear the term patient safety, they generally believe that the onus is on the healthcare provider to ensure that they're safe, they're kept safe throughout the entire care continuum. And from reading through your site and also some articles on the topic, it becomes pretty clear that accountability, as far as on the patient side, is becoming more of a key way to improve patient safety in healthcare. And what I mean is that instead of relying solely on a healthcare provider to keep you safe throughout the care continuum, it seems like there is a big push to get patients more involved in their own safety. And that has many different facets to it, first and foremost, being more aware of their surroundings. And so after reading a little bit about your summit and the innovation competition and some of the other materials on your website, it seems like the patient safety movement is also in this initiative to try and get patients to really be more aware of and accountable for their own safety in healthcare.
Yeah, the big issue there is that we think about doctors and hospitals as something you go to for a solution, right? And it's not always so black and white. There are many facets of healthcare. It's not just going to the doctor. It's not just the hospital. It's when you are discharged from the hospital. It's your ongoing care. It's health and wellness. I mean, healthcare is extremely complex. It's just easier for us to put it into these categories so that we're able to say, oh, well, that's something that happens in the hospital, or, oh, that's a medical device, or, oh, I should really be more healthy, or take my medicine. I think that the big thing that we're trying to do as an organization is really highlight the, not just that they're, it's bigger than that, but that when you look at all of these different pictures of healthcare, what should emerge is a connected picture of the patient. And unfortunately, right now, a lot of the times, it's the patient that has to manage their own care. And I think that the promise of health IT will get us closer. We can very well realize this idea of patient-centered care, because there will be better care coordination, and there are a lot of different ways where we can better pass information to the people that need it at the right time. But right now, it very much is patients, and families that are managing care or coordinating care across multiple providers. I would say that care coordination is a big one, because especially with our aging population, we're looking at a number of issues that are going to require multiple specialists or subspecialists. It's not just going to your primary care provider anymore. It's not just going to your specialist. It's not just going to your pharmacist. It's a network of those things. So I think patient engagement is key to understanding, or key to bringing them into that networked view of healthcare. The other thing is, on the patient safety side, outside of just care coordination, one of the big issues we have tried to really highlight is patient assertiveness. We see wildly ranging statistics around something as simple as hand washing in the healthcare setting. There are a lot of patient safety initiatives in hospitals that are focused on making sure that doctors and nurses wash their hands. And just even saying, hey, did you wash your hands, or hey, can you wash your hands, is something that I would say a majority of patients are afraid to do.
Right.
And so what we're really interested in is making sure that patients feel empowered, and also that patients have the tools available to them to either better manage their care or better manage the care of one of their loved ones.
That's great insight. Thank you, Jim. Let's talk for a moment, Jim, about healthcare digitization and its potential impact on patient safety, which we touched on at the introduction, and possibly examine the relationship between patient data integrity and patient safety. More specifically, I want to hear your thoughts on why patient safety is further jeopardized through healthcare digitization with the advent of things like mHealth apps, patient portals, and any other electronic access to personal health information and medical services. In fact, to support the urgency of this issue, I noticed just recently that the ECRI Institute listed data integrity issues that include incorrect or missing data in electronic healthcare records and other health IT systems as their number two patient safety concern. There's little doubt that improving and sustaining patient data integrity in healthcare has gained strong momentum due to its effect on the ability of clinicians to provide accurate, cost-effective care to a patient. So due to the increase in these new patient touch points that have manifested from the rapid digitization of healthcare, and I'm speaking again about things like patient portals, mHealth apps, kiosks, the use of a smartphone, these are all providing new ways to access this PHI, this personal health information, and receive services. My question is, what additional patient safety concerns have you worried that could potentially undermine patient data integrity?
The biggest issue that we see is that, very much like you said, we're in the era of digitization right now, but we've yet to enter the era of automation. Mm-hmm. So if you look at health IT right now, we're basically in this transition period from faxing everything to emailing, which is great for the fluidity of data. But at the same time, we're still thinking about things in the context of patient records, where you're thinking about the file that's in your file cabinet and not individual data elements and how those can be used. So I would say the biggest issues right now are, especially with the digitization of healthcare, is whether or not you can rely on the data that you're accessing. So one of the big issues around particularly data duplication has to do with either getting a lab result that you're not positive that is about that patient. And so from a better, safer care perspective, as a provider, you may order duplicate tests, or you may not necessarily trust the information that you're getting, which fundamentally undermines a lot of the care coordination models that are in place. So health information exchanges or payment models like accountable care organizations are all very reliant on having access to data, the correct data when you need it. And so from a patient safety perspective, there's a couple of things. One is that there may be data that is ignored because a healthcare professional doesn't necessarily trust the source of the data they're getting because it, you know, it hasn't demonstrated its validity. The other thing is that we're not going to realize the true value of health IT until we transition from that digitization to automation step so that we're actually getting some of the benefits like clinical decision support. I think there are a lot of programs and processes that are in place to get us there. I think a lot of the standardized vocabularies are a big part of that. I think that also the granular details that we can glean from what are more traditionally patient records is going to be very important. But until we're very much aware that the data that we're looking at is the data for that patient, we're not going to see the true gains in patient safety that we'd otherwise realize. So for us, from a patient safety perspective, a big thing that we are trying to kind of wrap our heads around is how can we make data more useful? How can we make sure that the data that's being introduced into the provider workflow is something that both the provider and the patient can trust?
Right. Trust is definitely a big issue when it comes to patient data integrity. Appreciate the feedback on that question, Jim. Let's turn our attention to the topic of patient identification in healthcare and its potential impact on patient safety. Jim, it's often said that accurate patient identification in healthcare is one of the key pillars of protecting patient safety throughout the care continuum. I think few people can argue with that. Considering the fact that many healthcare organizations still rely on outdated and ineffective patient matching methodologies, what new patient identification technologies do you see as promising to improve patient identification accuracy and patient data integrity that we talked about in the last question?
Sure. The big issue is that, especially in the U.S., we don't have unique ID. We don't have a patient ID. We don't have a national ID. And there are even legal barriers in place to make sure that's not even discussed at a federal level. So if you look at something like the HITECH Act, or you look at, well, which created meaningful use, or you look at Medicare Shared Savings Program, or any of these care coordination-based payment models or improvement programs, the number one thing that is essentially missing from that entire equation is how do you know someone is who they say they are? And, or in the event that they can't say who they are, so the idea of someone being rolled into an emergency ward unconscious, how do you get their information when you need it to improve safety? And with that, absent that single element, absent that patient ID, we need to get into strategies about how we can take the information we do have and better combine those data points to give us essentially a stratified score as to whether or not we have the right person. So it can't just be name. It can't just be something like social security number, because there are a lot of issues that can either be incorrect or improper. So the idea of multiple people having the same name, or somebody improperly using a social security number in the event of fraud. It's one thing to have your identity stolen. It's another thing to go into a healthcare situation and when your record is pulled up, it's not the right person. So what we've really seen that's been interesting, I think, has to do with both the use of authenticated biometrics, so something that is guaranteed, or at least there's some third-party guarantee that you have the biometric that was collected is for, in fact, that person. The other is collecting multiple data elements that tend to be so unique that you're able to at least create something akin to like a risk score as to whether or not the record you're seeing is for the proper individual. But I'll say it as many times as I can that absent that unique ID element that is widely accepted, we aren't going to make the gains we can in patient safety that we otherwise would.
I wanted to also ask you in conjunction with this question, Jim, about CHIME's National Patient Identifier Challenge. Are you aware of this, of what CHIME is doing?
The $1 million challenge.
Yes, correct. Have you had a chance to take a look kind of in depth about what they're asking people to submit?
I have like a baseline understanding of it, but I don't, not the deep details.
We hosted a tweet chat last week. Once a week, leaders in health IT get together and have a chat on Twitter under the hashtag HITSM. Last week, we hosted the chat specifically on Chime's National Patient Identifier Contest, as well as the conundrum of establishing patient identification in healthcare. And one of the things that we learned was that there seems to be, and this kind of goes in line with the answer to your last question, there seems to be a lot of head scratching going on with interoperability, which you've mentioned earlier in the podcast is one of the key ways to increase patient safety in healthcare. And of course, we're referring to the fluid exchange of healthcare data between not only systems that are cohesive, but also disparate providers. And one of the things that we learned was that or one of the head scratching moments that we had during the chat when we were talking about this contest was why there was not a more concrete patient identification initiative put in place prior to embarking on something like interoperability. And of course, you touched on it earlier. Congress has actually mandated that there's no funding that's to be allocated to any research or any action to be done on developing a national patient identifier for citizens of the U.S. So I think it's a pretty complex issue, and patient identification certainly and patient safety and going off what your answer, the last question was, really go hand in hand. And it doesn't sound like there's really any easy answer.
Well, there's not. And I think that you see a lot of options that are out there. One of the big ones that was being pushed a couple years ago, and I think still is being pushed, is a voluntary ID number that people could essentially opt into a program to have a voluntary ID that's being kept outside of the government system. Well, that's fine, but the issue, and I think that is a direction we could go. The problem isn't the people that are willing to opt in, right? I mean, that's the least of the concern. The more is the people that are more intensively using the healthcare system that may not be so aware of their healthcare, may not be keeping a personal health record, may not keep all their records in one place, kind of episodic users. So the major issue there is that a lot of the strategies in place are, or a lot of the approaches in place are for the engaged, not the not engaged. And so, but the point you raise where it, legally we can't discuss a national ID using federal funds, and a number of other issues that are real inhibitors to the usefulness of health IT are reflective of a legal regulatory framework that is for a bygone era. So this idea of not using a national ID, I think that it was fine because we didn't really pressure test the system in a paper-based world. But now here we are trying to force doctors and hospitals to get into these shared savings or accountable care models, but they're hamstrung by the fact that all of that is reliant on using health information technology to get productivity gains. And you're not going to get the productivity gains you could. We're not going to see huge gains in this area unless we have a better idea of the patient records we're working with. And a unique ID would certainly help in that regard. Now, that said, what do you do, right? I mean, because this is the big issue is, yeah, that would be ideal, but how do we work in the context of the law of the land? And I think there's a lot of room for innovation here. But that said, you're going to get the critical mass. It's not going to be done by some kind of off-to-the-side system. It has to be something that very clearly integrates into provider workflows. And I think that there's a lot of work from the health IT vendors on that side. I think there's also a lot of work from the payers on this side. And in my personal opinion, the big gains we're going to see as far as improving patient identification are likely going to come from the payers and maybe even employers who are the real purchasers versus the, just the payers, because they're going to see the benefit of having a better idea of care coordination. Quite honestly, the more cohesive use of health information and technology.
Okay. Thank you so much for that additional feedback, Jim. Turning our attention to the rising use of biometrics for patient identification in healthcare, which we talked briefly about before we started the podcast today, I want to get your thoughts on the safety of this technology as it applies to hospital infection control. Earlier in the podcast, Jim, you alluded to hand washing and hand hygiene as being extremely important for patient safety in a clinical environment. And I kind of want to talk to you a little bit about the use of biometrics and how that fits into infection control. I think I saw a statistic on your website that approximately 1/3 of all hospital deaths can be prevented by applying routine hand washing techniques for anyone coming in contact with patients. So I know you understand the significance of hygiene in a clinical setting. And as our listeners may or may not know, basically biometric patient identification solutions that are currently available for healthcare providers offer a choice of different biometric hardware modalities to use. Some that require physical contact, for example, fingerprints, palm vein, those types of biometrics technologies, and others that don't, for example, iris recognition, which uses a camera that just takes your photograph and there's no contact involved. So the growth of biometrics for patient identification represents an opportunity for healthcare organizations to modernize their patient authentication protocols and improve patient safety by eliminating duplicate medical records and preventing things like medical identity theft and fraud at the point of service. Jim, we recently, and this is the company I work for, Right Patient, conducted a survey of over 1,000 patients about infection control policies in healthcare and preferences regarding biometric technology, and we found that 70% prefer a non-contact biometric patient identification device. Based on your experience in patient safety, why do you think this is the case?
It's an interesting, the view of the patient population is very interesting on that. I think that when you look at hospital-acquired infections or you look at hospital cleanliness, those that would be answering the affirmative on a survey like that are probably more aware of the concern about hygiene. So I think that people opting away from touching something makes a lot of sense, particularly if they're aware of the of some of the statistics around hospital-acquired conditions. It's interesting also because if you look at any of the other biometric programs, even outside of the hospital, they're very focused on at least we're getting to fingerprint, at least we're getting to handprint, but we're not seeing as much of the use of iris scans, right? Mm-hmm. And so I think healthcare is a great opportunity for that because A, it's something that is quick and easy, but also I think that people also would look at the use of such a scan as probably more secure than something just like a fingerprint because their fingerprint may have been used elsewhere. So I think it's a mix between a hygiene issue and also just individual understanding of the technology itself. But the data that you're getting back, it is interesting. And I would say it's reflective of a lot of what we're hearing as well.
So let me ask you, Jim, if a provider is evaluating a contact-dependent device to use for patient identification, for example, a fingerprint reader or a palm vein reader, what would these providers need to consider in terms of hygiene and infection control if they do decide they're going to deploy these types of devices throughout the hospital environment?
I would say the ability to clean it is a big issue. I mean, we've seen a number of environmental safety issues that lead to healthcare acquired conditions. So something is, you know, the old example we always hear is doctors wearing ties. Well, you know, you clean your shirt, but how often do you clean your tie? Is one example.
That's really interesting. I never even thought of that. My gosh. Right. You're right.
Or the curtains between beds. They're very tall. I mean, ceilings in hospitals are generally pretty tall. So if you look at the cleaning staff, how high up can they actively clean it, right? So, you know, one of the things I always thought was very interesting was why there was such a big uptake of iPads in hospitals. And I always thought, well, I mean, Apple has a pretty good lock on the market, but even though they had compatibility issues with some of the EHR systems. And the number one thing was it was a single piece of glass, so it was easier for them to clean. And that at first was for a work safety thing. So this was providers that were maybe taking it home with themselves and they wanted to essentially wipe the hospital off of it before they went home. Mm-hmm. Now, think of that in the context of trying to do authenticated biometrics. If you have a number of hands touching the same place, it's hard enough for us to get everybody to use hand sanitizer before they go into the hospital while they're in the hospital, let alone cleaning off something that may not be entirely flat. So, you know, it gets into a lot of the environmental safety issues, and I know hospitals spend a lot of time and money trying to solidify such a thing as far as their own processes go. So I would say that for us, from a patient safety perspective, A, we want to make sure that there's identity integrity in there to make sure that the records that are being pulled in are appropriate to the individual, but also the from safety element, say the cleanliness is a big issue and cleanability is a big issue.
Thank you for your insight, Jim. I appreciate that. Let's turn our attention back to the patient safety movement for a moment, and more specifically, something that jumped out at me immediately when I went to your site, and that is the goals and objectives you have to achieve zero preventable deaths by the year 2020. It's an aggressive goal. It's an admirable goal. But my question is, in the patient safety movement mission statement, you talk a lot about breaking down the silos in healthcare. Can you explain your interpretation of what breaking down the silos actually means and why you feel this is an important component to advance the patient safety initiative?
Sure. Healthcare is unlike any other marketplace. If you look at any other industry, if you look at any other consumer, things that a consumer engages in, it's very different. It's extremely regulated, but at the same time, there are a lot of big players involved. And when we say breaking down the silos, really what we're talking about is, in this super regulated market, is there a way that these people can better coordinate? So that's hospitals, that's insurance companies, that's med tech companies, that's pharmaceutical companies, that's patients. But quite honestly, what is the one thing that may institutionally be keeping them from connecting to each other? And that's the law. And so we look at the legal regulatory framework and say, all right, what are some of the main issues that are preventing us from taking decisive action in patient safety? And so when we say breaking down the silos, really what we're focusing on is not only connecting the people that are engaged in healthcare on a day-to-day basis, but also what are some of the major hurdles that stand in the way of better coordination. And so we have a really strong public policy focus, and I think that's central to breaking down these barriers, but also just better coordination overall. It is going to be very much heavily based in making sure that the legal regulatory framework are susceptible to change.
So you touched on this a little bit, but what do you feel is this distinct advantage that coalescing these fragmented and disparate entities in healthcare have to advance patient safety in healthcare? In other words, what would be, in your mind, if you had a crystal ball, the end result of bringing these disparate entities together in healthcare and trying to, as you said in your mission statement, break down the silos?
Well, I would say the major issue is that because this is such a heavily regulated marketplace, mm-hmm. Everybody's regulated differently, right? So hospitals have to play by a certain number of rules. Insurance companies have to play by a certain number of rules. Medical technology companies, same thing. Pharma, same thing. So I think that the big issue is that in the development of this regulation, in the development of the law, they're hearing only, legislators and decision makers are only hearing part of the story. And so what we're trying to do is, by bringing these fragments together, understand how organizations can better coordinate with the goal of being able to better portray what the benefits of that coordination would look like to decision makers. So if it is something that hospitals need to get to point X in order to reduce acquired infections, that point isn't just going to come from the hospitals. It's also going to come from industry. It's also going to come from patient engagement. It's also going to come from better understanding of payment structures as well. And it's my personal opinion, I think it fits very well into the mission of this organization, is saying that, quite honestly, the legal framework that we have for healthcare right now has a lot of blind spots in it, and we're trying to shine some light on those blind spots.
It's a great way of putting it. Thank you, Jim. Finally, I'd like to discuss accountability in the context of patient safety for a moment. We did talk very briefly about it earlier in the podcast, but more specifically, I'd like to discuss the often nebulous way that hospitals report duplicate medical record and overlays in their electronic health record systems. I feel like this is an important topic due to the inherent danger and patient safety risks that duplicate medical records and overlays present to patients. And for our listeners who aren't familiar with or understand the differences between the terms duplicate medical record and overlay, let me take a moment and explain what they are and what the difference actually is. Created as a result of patient misidentification, a duplicate medical record is when a single patient is associated with more than one medical record. Oftentimes, duplicate medical records are considered partial duplicates that only capture a portion of a patient's medical history. So in other words, clinicians aren't looking at the full medical history when they treat a patient due to the fact that there might be an additional medical record that is floating out there that the physician did not know about or the clinician, whoever it might be. Whereas an overlay occurs when one patient's record is overwritten with data from another patient's record, creating a combined inaccurate record. In fact, I've heard several industry experts say that they feel overlays are sometimes even more dangerous to patient safety than a duplicate medical record. So in our experience, tying this together, our experience has basically proven that virtually every hospital we communicate with underestimates the amount of duplicate medical records and overlays in their EHR system, which to us is a little troubling because underestimating this number, we feel, creates a false pretense that patient safety risk is minimal because of duplicates and overlays, and often results in an inaction by these healthcare organizations until some sort of an adverse event happens due to the presence of a duplicate or overlay. Or conversely, what we're also seeing is hospitals and healthcare systems who address cleaning of an MPI, of a master patient index, of any duplicates or of any overlays, often don't take that next step to incorporate technology to sustain the cleanliness of that database. So my question for you, Jim, is why are hospitals allowed to operate under the radar with issues such as duplicates and overlays that pose such a significant risk to patient safety? And adding on to that, who governs this? And why isn't this industry-wide epidemic made more public so that patients and regulators are made aware of this issue?
Well, you hit on it with your last part of the question. First and foremost, this is the piece that isn't. Mm-hmm. So electronic health records aren't medical devices, and you know, data is not a medical device. So they remain outside of the regulatory structure. You have people in the highest levels of the health IT policy. So think of like the Office of National Coordinator, you know, a former national coordinator or acting national coordinator, Jacob Ryder, his number one issue that he used to focus on was the usability of the records. But right now, that's a little bit nebulous. It's not something as repeatable as something you would see with a medical device. Usability is kind of something that is subjective. And so for that reason, the regulatory structures around how you would guarantee health IT safety, there are a lot of question marks in the air. In the traditional 510K or pre-market approval process that FDA, you know, the tools in the toolbox right now probably don't apply very well to how you would regulate something like electronic health records. So I would say that's the first part. Mm-hmm. The other is we haven't even seen the real issue yet, because as much as there are a number of hospitals that have increased been incentivized to use electronic health records, they've been incentivized to use it, but something like the Meaningful Use Program is very process oriented. So it's not fundamentally a part of the workflow of a lot of doctors and hospitals yet. And for that reason, we haven't seen a lot of the patient safety issues because, you know, what's the worst part? What's the worst thing that can happen? We just order the test again. What's the worst thing that can happen? We just create a new record. And that gets into the duplication side. Mm-hmm. I think that there are the commingled or overlay issue is probably a more dangerous one, like you were saying, because think of the doctor that sees 10 kids with ear infections in the morning and they're cutting and pasting across different records. Well, that's a bigger issue when you start to look at meds and med management, because you don't want to be copying things across multiple patients, because that's when you start to get into the things that the record can only help you decide in the context of what it knows. And if what it knows is information that was input incorrectly, that the decision support and the safety guardrails essentially disappear. And so from our perspective, our concern is we're certainly focused on interoperability and we want data sharing. That's very important to us. But we want to make sure that when those data elements are gathered, that the correct patient emerges from the center of all that data.
So Jim, let me ask you, in your opinion, should there be an industry level of transparency where it's mandated that a hospital's exposure to such issues, duplicate medical records and overlays, is made public, constantly monitored, penalized, and regulated?
Well, I would say that if you look at other facets of healthcare, you know, in 2005, the Patient Safety Act created patient safety organizations, which allowed for protective disclosure by healthcare professionals to these federally identified patient safety organizations, and with the goal of allowing them to get to the bottom of an issue before it became something that may happen to another patient. Mm-hmm. I would say that you mentioned ECRI earlier. They're getting reports on medical devices. They're getting reports on electronic health records. But the big issue is that the vendors themselves aren't able to make similar reports. So it's incumbent upon the doctor to highlight what the problem is. And oftentimes there's a concern about liability there. So one of the things as far as breaking down the silos or kind of uniting the healthcare ecosystem is I would hope that these vendors are collecting a lot of data and they're seeing a lot of, they may be witnessing duplication or witnessing near misses just through their own quality control mechanisms that are in place, but there's no way to report that information yet. So I would say if you want to get true transparency, it's not just going to come from the docs, it's going to come from the vendors as well. But I would think that we probably have to offer them the similar protections that we offer to healthcare professionals as well to make sure that they're comfortable doing it.
Excellent insight. Thank you so much for your feedback on that topic, Jim. For more information on the patient safety movement, please visit their website at www.patientsafetymovement.org. Follow them on Twitter at 0x2020. Did I get that right, Jim?
That's right.
Okay, and that refers to zero preventable deaths by the year 2020, which we talked about earlier in the podcast. And please like their page on Facebook, which you can find by typing Patient Safety Movement in the Facebook search field. Jim, did I miss any other ways to follow the Patient Safety Movement?
No, just to keep track of what we're doing as far as our 2016 summit. We're announcing some really interesting and exciting speakers.
Okay, and we'll put a link up to the summit on our website as well as a link to the Patient Safety Movement homepage. This concludes our podcast for today. We hope that you enjoyed the topic and our guest and encourage you to tune in to future podcasts where we interview industry professionals on topics that relate to the healthcare industry. Thank you for your time today, Jim. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
For a full list of all our podcasts, please visit our podcast page at www.rightpatient.com/healthcare-biometrics-podcasts. If you have an idea or podcast topic you would like to see us cover, please send an email with a topic idea and a suggested industry expert for an interview to jtrader, that's J-T-R-A-D-E-R, at rightpatient.com, and we will work out whatever we can on our calendar. See you on our next podcast.